This is the takeaway for Monday, March 19th, 2018.
This is the takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thanks for being with us today. President Trump is continuing his purge of federal law enforcement as Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation gets closer and closer to him. FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe was fired by Attorney General Jeff Sessions late Friday, just 2 days before McCabe's retirement date that would have qualified him for a pension after more than 2 decades of service at the FBI. President Trump goaded Andrew McCabe on Twitter, saying that McCabe knew about lies and corruption at the FBI. And Andrew McCabe responded. He released a statement calling his firing part of this administration's ongoing war on the FBI and the efforts of the special counsel investigation, which continue to this day. Now, Andrew McCabe was already shoved aside at the FBI, and his firing right before retirement had some lawmakers offering jobs over the weekend to get McCabe his pension. But what about help from Republicans? Not for Andrew McCabe himself, but for their responsibility for congressional oversight here. Over a president who's calling law enforcement of the people he perceives to be his enemies, and the attorney general, who recused himself from all matters related to the 2016 campaign and the Russia investigation. Ryan Goodman is co-editor-in-chief of Just Security and a former special counsel at the Defense Department. Ryan, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
What's been the fallout in the 2 days since this firing, in your estimation?
So I think there's two parts to the fallout. One is a big concern about the survival of the Mueller investigation. Because of the president's tweets on Saturday night and Sunday morning, he seemed to be taking as his direct target the Mueller investigation itself. And that followed on the heels of his own lawyer on Saturday morning saying that the McCabe firing gave a reason why the Mueller investigation should now be wrapped up. So I think that's one of the biggest issues. And then the second issue that's a big fallout is Jeff Sessions. So the way in which this was handled by the Justice Department is highly irregular, and some senators have already been calling for him to come before the Senate to explain what exactly went on here.
Well, let's talk about Andrew McCabe a little bit more, because his firing 2 days before his retirement to many people in Washington, Ryan, seemed especially vindictive. I think that's fair to say. McCabe has already been forced out of his job. So what do you think was motivating the move to oust him just 2 days before he earned his retirement benefits?
So it's difficult to tell, and in a certain sense, we all have to hold judgment, because the underlying investigation and the report by the Inspector General has not been made public. And in a way, we're relying on Jeff Sessions' interpretation of what the Inspector General concluded. So it's also therefore difficult to tell what the motivation is. The worst form of motivation might in fact be obstruction of justice and trying to discredit McCabe as a witness to the investigation of the president for obstruction of justice. McCabe himself, when he became the acting director of the FBI, told the senior leadership in the FBI that they all needed to be alert to the fact that they were potential witnesses for the grand jury. And the way in which he has been forced out does seem to raise the question, at the very least, if this is part of the kind of assault on those leaders of the FBI. It had been reported already that the president himself, months ago, had determined to target the leadership of the FBI for these purposes. So it raises that as the worst kind of motive. Another kind of motive, of course, could be vindictiveness or retribution, that he would lose his pension because he's 26 hours away from reaching the point in his service that he would have gotten his pension. And I suppose another kind of justification that I've tried to think through in terms of the strongest argument on behalf of Jeff Sessions and the way he handled it is that they wanted to make sure that McCabe left as being fired, not as having resigned because of the improper conduct. But even the improper conduct that's alleged here doesn't seem to rise to the level that you would do that to somebody who served the government at its highest levels for 21 years.
Now, the Inspector General report that everyone is expecting hasn't been released yet. There have been some leaks about it, maybe selective ones. But what do we know about what the Inspector General thinks Andrew McCabe did wrong during the 2016 campaign that might have earned him the attention of the Attorney General in the first place?
So the Inspector General is conducting a wide-ranging investigation of how the FBI handled various matters, including the Clinton email scandal. And it seems to be that part of the investigation found that McCabe had acted improperly by leaking information to the media and by, quote-unquote, lacking candor in his interviews with investigators.
Lacking candor and leaking, not about Donald Trump, but about Hillary Clinton.
That's right. So something that's very important for people to understand is that the so-called leak or the alleged leak by McCabe did not favor Hillary Clinton. It disfavored her in the race. And you can look at the late October Wall Street Journal news story that was apparently the product of the leak. And it's actually saying that McCabe wanted to go full force or fuller force in the investigation of the Clinton Foundation.
But if it's the case, of course, and it is the case that Jeff Sessions fired Andrew McCabe, Ryan, it seems like they're cutting a pretty fine line here. I mean, if Andrew McCabe was fired for his conduct during the 2016 campaign, I suppose that's one thing. But he's probably a material witness in the Mueller investigation. And I seem to remember the attorney general recusing himself from anything having to do with that investigation.
That's correct. I think that's, for me, the second part of the fallout from this investigation, which is Jeff Sessions. He entered a statement of recusal that he would be recused from anything related to the campaign. And I think what's even more important in a certain sense is what he specifically said to the Senate Judiciary Committee in his confirmation hearings in specific response to specific questions by the chair of the committee, Senator Grassley.
I believe the proper thing for me to do would be to recuse myself from any questions involving those kind of investigations that involve Secretary Clinton.
The McCabe piece of this deals with those issues. And the attorney general is supposed to remain free of any appearance of conflict of interest. The very next day, within 24 hours, both the president's lawyer and the president are saying because of the McCabe firing, the Russia investigation should be drawn to a close. That draws the connection directly to the space in which Jeff Sessions should have not been in, because that means that he was directly in the space that's dealing with the Russia investigation. So that's a huge part of the fallout in a certain sense, because the public should be able to be rest assured that there were no impure motives on the part of the attorney general. But right now we're dealing with a political storm about the fact that the McCabe firing is being connected to the Russia investigation.
Ryan Goodman, thanks so much for coming back.
Thank you.
Ryan Goodman is co-editor-in-chief of Just Security and a former special counsel at the Defense Department. So one part of Andrew McCabe's firing stems from how he handled the FBI investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Other emails stolen from the DNC and disseminated by WikiLeaks, of course, played a huge role in the 2016 election. And you can follow that line through to another scandal that surfaced on Friday. Facebook suspended its ties with a company called Cambridge Analytica after it was revealed that that company was using personal information of more than 50 million users. Now, the company played a role in the 2016 elections as well, working closely with the Trump campaign. Facebook is now under fire for what it knew about what Cambridge Analytica was doing, and it's raised a lot of questions about what role Cambridge itself had in the 2016 campaign. Issy Lepowski is a senior writer for Wired.
Cambridge Analytica is a U.S.-based company that is an offshoot of a British company that's been around for some time called SCL. And Cambridge is basically an ad targeting company, but their big sales pitch to people is that we do something called psychographic targeting, which is different than demographic targeting. Cambridge tells its clients, you know, we have some understanding of people's personalities. And the reason we have that understanding is because we have built profiles on tens of millions of Americans. And the question for so long has been, well, how did they do that? And I've asked them that question myself. Their argument has always been, well, we conduct surveys, we use commercially available data that we purchase. But what we're finding out is there's a lot more to it. In 2015, we heard some rumblings that Cambridge had worked with a researcher who created an app that was basically collecting all of this personality data from people. And people were willingly downloading this app, but what a lot of people didn't realize was that by downloading the app, they were not only handing over to this researcher all of their own data, but data on their entire friend networks. And what was never supposed to happen, and what's the real scandal now, is that researcher who created the app passed that information along, all 50 million users worth, to Cambridge Analytica and to SCL. And that was information that was really foundational to these psychographic profiles that they built on all of America.
Now, Issy, these psychographic profiles are one thing, but Cambridge Analytica isn't using them to sell fancy luxury cars. They were working with the Trump campaign.
Exactly. So this is a really important point. Cambridge Analytica is best known because they were a vendor to the Trump campaign. That means they had staff working inside the San Antonio digital office for the Trump campaign. But what the Trump campaign has made clear, what I've heard through my sources, is that that staff was not necessarily working with Cambridge Analytica data, the data that's, you know, so in question right now. They were working with RNC data. But that doesn't mean that this data wasn't being used in the 2016 election at all. You have to remember, well before Cambridge was working with the Trump campaign, they were working with the Ted Cruz campaign, which didn't have access to Republican National Committee data at the time. So it's fair to say that this data was used in some way or another during the run-up to the election to target American voters.
Well, Facebook announced late on Friday, Issy, that they were breaking ties with Cambridge Analytica. But then the question is, why now, when a lot of the details of this story, or at least stolen data, were reported months ago?
The answer to why now is because they got caught. And they were hearing from the New York Times and from the Guardian that this was coming. They'd been talking to them for a week, and all of a sudden they decide, we need to get ahead of this story. Late on Friday night, the story broke on Saturday morning. Facebook found out about this in 2015, and Facebook has obligations to its users to alert them if they're data has been accessed by an unauthorized source, and they knew very well it had been. At the time, Facebook went to Cambridge Analytica and SCL and the researcher himself and, you know, made them swear up and down that they had deleted every remnant of the data. They eventually made them sign a legally binding agreement, which honestly is really the most that Facebook can do at that point, and that's the big problem, right? Facebook provides these clients so much data, and then when it finds out they're misusing it, it has very little recourse to get it back and ensure it's deleted. And what we're finding out now through my reporting, through the New York Times reporting, is that it seems as if Cambridge did not, in fact, get rid of all that data. I spoke with sources close to the company who said that as recently as 2017, some of that data was visible to a limited number of staffers within the company.
So that's one side of this, Issy, whether this private entity should have had their hands on this data. And then the other side is the potential connections to the presidential campaign. At this point in this whole investigation, what do people need to know about Cambridge Analytica and connections to the Trump campaign, supporters of the Trump campaign, or advisors to the president himself?
Right. So there are so many ties. As I said, you know, Cambridge Analytica was working closely with the Trump campaign. Obviously, the Trump campaign in the midst of all of this has tried to distance itself from the company, but they did have staff in there and they did work closely with them. But then there's a whole other issue, right? We have to remember that Alexander Nix, the CEO of Cambridge Analytica, was also named as somebody who reached out to Julian Assange to discuss what were being heavily hyped as these hacked emails that were going to bring down Hillary Clinton at the time. So they've just been leaving behind this sort of trail of devious, deceptive behavior that is definitely weakening their credibility.
Issy Lipowski for Wired. Thanks, Issy.
Thank you.
We go to Austin, Texas now, where a fourth bomb exploded last night. The city's been on edge over the last few weeks after package bombs killed two people and left two other people seriously hurt. This latest attack injured two more people, and police say there are similarities between all four devices. This most recent explosion went off in the Travis Country neighborhood of Austin. KUT engineer David Alvarez lives three blocks away from where the bomb went off, and he recalled driving back to his home after dinner.
When we reached that entry point, we saw dozens, I mean, lots of vehicles, and probably, I don't know, 40 or so people wearing FBI, you know, jackets.
The neighborhood was on lockdown until 10 a.m. local time today. Alvarez was on KUT's local Morning Edition broadcast.
I don't feel personally like I'm under any threat. You know, I got a text from a friend who doesn't live in Travis Country who said, well, this is a terroristic thing. I'm hesitant to use that word because of what it means to people. But yeah, anyway, I'm staying on our porch and I hear nothing but birds in the trees. So, you know, life goes on.
Saida Hassan is back with us now with the latest. Saida is a reporter for KUT in Austin.
This latest attack took place in a completely different neighborhood in southwest Austin. The previous bombings predominantly took place on the east side of town. And we also know that this latest explosion seems to have been set up in a very different way. Those previous explosions were all package bombs that were left on people's doorsteps and appear to have been triggered by folks either moving or handling those packages. This latest explosion appears to have been set off by some sort of tripwire that was set up along the side of the road, and police believe that the two victims were either riding their bicycles or walking their bicycles down the sidewalk, and they may have set off the tripwire in this case.
Now, two victims who died last week when we last spoke, Saida, were African American. A third victim was a Hispanic woman. In this case, the two victims were white, and so there was a theory before that the cases might be connected, but that they might have a racial motivation as well. Are police still investigating that possibility?
Yes. As of now, we haven't heard any changes in terms of whether or not police are looking into the possibility of a hate crime or terrorism or any kind of racial motivation. They have not ruled that out at this point, even though the victims of this latest attack were both white men in their 20s. So folks are, you know, still kind of searching for answers here. And it seems to be, you know, even though this has been a departure from previous attacks that we've seen, those earlier explosions that took place predominantly in East Austin, a lot of those neighborhoods are historically African American. The third explosion that took place was in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood. And this latest one took place in a Southwest Austin neighborhood that, just anecdotally, I've heard is a predominantly white neighborhood. So that's certainly a departure from what we've seen in the previous attacks. And that's led folks to kind of question whether or not these attacks may, in fact, be racially motivated. There's really not a whole lot of answers in terms of what the motivation of this attacker or attackers may be at this point.
There's so many questions around the motivation and what would drive a person or people to mount attacks like this. How are people in the community reacting now?
Well, I think that there has been a lot of confusion, a lot of fear, especially just with the unpredictable and seemingly random nature of these attacks. People are scared. And, it, you know, the fact that this latest explosion seems to have been set off by this tripwire, I've seen some folks saying that, you know, we can look out for suspicious packages, but, you know, is everyone supposed to walk around town looking out for tripwires on sidewalks? It really makes it difficult to know, you know, if this happens again, where this type of attack may occur or how it might be triggered, since the nature of that seems to be changing. I've seen some folks talking about, you know, wondering why these attacks haven't been labeled as terrorism. And again, police have not explicitly called it that, but again, they are not ruling that out as a potential motivation or potential classification for these attacks. So, and I know that there have also been folks talking about a lack of media coverage. Just here locally, I know that every local outlet has really been on top of the story and following it closely and attending the police briefings. And we've also been sharing that with our national partners as well. So, you know, it seems that despite that coverage here locally, some folks have been concerned that this is not receiving widespread attention from the national media.
You know, back in 2002, there were the infamous sniper attacks in and around Washington, D.C. that spread a lot of terror and a lot of misinformation while they were still going on. Lots of theories. And in the end, it turned out to be two people who were mounting these attacks for personal reasons to cover up another murder, a crime related to one of the assailants' ex-wives. It just goes to show how twisted and complicated motivations can be now. And I wonder if authorities are trying to tamp down speculation of terrorism or other motivations when they just don't know the motives here.
Right. I think that it's clear that there is just a lack of information and a lack of clarity at this point. Earlier in the day on Sunday, before this latest explosion took place, police actually held another press conference where they doubled the award for information leading to an arrest that they are offering. It went from $50,000 to now a $100,000 reward. And they actually, during that press conference Sunday morning, spoke directly to the attacker and said, you know, we want to communicate with you. We want to understand what type of message it is that you're trying to send.
These events in Austin have garnered worldwide attention, and we assure you that we are listening. We want to understand what brought you to this point, and we want to listen to you.
So, you know, it's tough to know, but it does seem to be kind of this real moment of uncertainty and a lot of speculation naturally going around in the community just with those lack of answers.
A fourth explosion in Austin. Many, many questions around what's motivating bomb attacks around the city. Saida Hassan with KUT in Austin. Saida, thank you.
Thank you.
Want more information about the stories you hear on The Takeaway? Check out thetakeaway.org for more facts, figures, and news from guests and contributors and opinions from your fellow listeners. Leave us a note or comment on a story you heard, all at thetakeaway.org.
Great to have you with us. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go to Illinois now, where voters head to the polls for primaries on Tuesday. Democrats are divided on at least one congressional primary in Illinois. That's a race that could give an indication of just how liberal Democrats want to be in the Trump era. There's also a governor's seat up for grabs, and current Republican Governor Bruce Rauner is being challenged from within his own party. Here's Bruce Rauner talking to reporters last year.
We would have lower property taxes in this state. We would have term limits in this state if I was in charge. I am not in charge. I'm trying to get to be in charge.
Bruce Rauner is trying to get to be in charge, and so are a lot of other people, too, in that race. Some big, wealthy names. Bruce Rauner is one. There's a Pritzker in this race and also a Kennedy. Just to round it out, Tony Arnold is state politics reporter for WBEZ in Chicago. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good to be with you.
Good to have you, Tony. Let's start with this congressional race in District 3, which is a weirdly shaped district in the Chicago suburbs. Congressman Dan Lipinski is trying to keep his seat. He's a Democrat. Now, Lipinski is anti-abortion rights. He's a conservative Democrat. And there's a lot of people watching his primary, whether Democrats want to have a purity test on abortion rights. What's going on in the 3rd District there?
I think that's a good summary there. It's really a question of, is there the way that Lipinski's framing this, the incumbent, who I should add is a very longtime incumbent. He's been there for more than 10 years. His main question is there really no more room for positions like these in the Democratic Party that is not in favor of gay marriage or is pro-life. He voted against Obamacare, and he didn't really support Obama during his re-election bid in 2012. So I think that there's been a lot of questions about from the other side of the Democratic Party about how, you know, is there no more room for this kind of position here? And this is something that's really created this opponent of his, Marie Newman, to be extremely well funded, well supported by other, you know, the other fraction of the Democratic Party.
People are using the term purity test when it comes to this primary. And Tony, one thing that was remarkable here is that other members of Congress from Illinois, people like Jan Schakowsky from Chicago, you know, it's traditional in congressional politics. You support the incumbent when they're running to keep their seat. That's the normal way of doing things. Jan Schakowsky's not supporting Dan Lipinski here.
Yeah, it's created some interesting divisions within the party. It's interesting too. Lipinski and as he defends his record so far, he's been saying that his opponent, Marie Newman, is part of the Tea Party of the left, and she's been saying, I don't know what that means. That's not a term that's used. Just because I would have voted in favor of Obamacare. I support gay marriage. I support abortion, or abortion rights, I should say. So it's interesting to see, especially within the Illinois delegation, that these longtime alliances that have really been around for ages to be fractured in this year of all years. This district is part of Chicago's southwest suburbs, as you mentioned. It's kind of known as the Bungalow Belt. Some blue-collar workers make up the district. Lipinski took over the seat from his father, who had the seat for years, and was well known for bringing a lot of transportation money in particular to the district. So it's a name that the Lipinski name is very well known there, and there's a lot of alliances that he had within the Illinois Democratic Party. And now to see in 2018 a lot of those same alliances fracture off in favor of his opponent, it's cause for a very dramatic, very intense, and very heated primary on the Democratic side.
Tony, let's turn to the governor's race now. Governor Bruce Rauner, we heard from him at the top. He's facing a primary challenge from within his own party. Is that unusual for starters?
It's not necessarily unusual. I think it's unusual, though, how intense this race in particular has gotten, just because in previous years, I don't know that it's been as competitive when an incumbent governor is challenged from within his own party, and they've tended to win pretty easily, even with that challenge. I think what's making this a little different is where Rauner staked out his positions on a few social issues. He has campaigned in when he ran in 2014 as this wealthy outsider, successful in business, if that narrative sounds familiar. He said that I'm not really running to deal with social issues. I'm running to fix the state's finances, which are significant. But that said, the Democrats who control the legislature have passed a few bills that got to the governor's desk that were about social issues, and that forced him to take a stand and sign a few, in particular one that allows Medicaid to pay for abortions. When he signed that, he obviously upset a lot of members of the right wing of his own Republican Party, and one of them, State Representative Jeannie Ives, is now running to Rauner's right. She part of it is about this abortion bill. Part of it is about her support of Donald Trump. And Rauner infrequently, if almost ever, says Donald Trump's name. He doesn't even want to usually talk about the president.
And before we run, Tony, we have to talk about the Democrats on their side of the governor's race, because, as I mentioned, there are some big names. J.B. Pritzker from the Pritzker family that controls Hyatt Hotels, and also a Kennedy in this race, and a whole lot of money.
A whole lot of money is right, and that's what this primary has come down to in a lot of ways. The Pritzker has put $70 million of his own money into this race. If it's not a record, it's got to be close. It's a three-way race, really, between Pritzker, Kennedy, and then a state senator, Daniel Biss. Biss's whole argument for his campaign is, I can't self-fund my campaign, so I'm going to rely on other people. And he's been trying to recruit the progressive wing of the Democratic Party in that race. It's been a fascinating primary to watch.
Primaries on Tuesday in Illinois, with implications for Democrats in congressional races. And everyone's watching Republican and Democratic primaries to see who might be in position to take control of Illinois. Tony Arnold for WBEZ in Chicago. Thanks, Tony.
All right, thanks.
What happens when prison inmates get sick or grow old and reach the end of their lives? In the 1980s, Congress created compassionate release. And the idea was to allow aging or terminally ill federal prisoners an early release so they could die at home near their loved ones. But an investigation by the Marshall Project finds that compassionate release is rarely granted, and even when it is, it's sometimes too late.
They just told me that he had passed during the morning. When they checked on him, and that they would be mailing me his stuff, and that someone from the place that they take care of the cremations would be mailing me his ashes.
That's Kim Giraldez. Her father was eventually granted release from federal prison after 4 applications, but he died 2 days before he was due to come home. Long delays and repeated applications are common in the compassionate release system. That's according to the Marshall Project, and Christy Thompson helped run their investigation.
You put in an application to your warden. They vet it. They have a social worker go to your home to make sure that there's a safe, comfortable place for you to live if you are released. The records are looked at by the doctors in the prison. They're looked at by the social worker. They look at your prison disciplinary history. And after you go through all of that, then it gets passed on to the central office of the Bureau of Prisons. They have all of their people, several different steps, look at it. And only then does it get passed on to a judge who ultimately makes the final decision of whether you get out. So that whole process can take, on average, just to get an answer from the Bureau of Prisons, longer than 6 months.
And in many of these cases, it's terminally ill inmates, right? So I would imagine in some cases it's sort of a race against the clock.
Exactly. So the process moves so slowly, but at the meantime, you have people who are facing, you know, terminal cancer, other debilitating diseases. So what we found in the data that we got is that, you know, there's been hundreds of cases where people have died before they ever got a final answer.
Well, Kevin Zeke was a man who was in prison for a couple of decades, 27 years, was terminally ill. His daughter is Kim Geraldez. Tell me their story.
Kevin was diagnosed with advanced bile duct cancer, and it progressed pretty quickly due to several other health conditions he had. He couldn't see, he couldn't walk or write, had trouble sleeping or eating. And multiple times he was told, not by his personal doctors, but by the Central Bureau of Prisons, that he wasn't sick enough. They thought that his life expectancy was indeterminate. They say in the records that it was seemed to be longer than 18 months. And finally, on the fourth try, they finally approved him and said, yes, it seems that you are going to die within the next 18 months. We agree to let you go home. At that point, the judge signed off on it immediately. Kim, his daughter, gets a call that her dad's coming home.
He got approved. It was a Friday. They left me a voicemail saying that he would be on the next plane on a Monday. And then Saturday morning, I got a call that he had passed away.
Is there a standard of whether 18 months of life expectancy merits compassionate release, or whether it's 12 months or six? Or is that completely up to a judge ultimately? What's the guidance here?
The guidelines are issued by the Bureau of Prisons, and they have set it at 18 months. When several years ago, it used to be 6 months, then it got expanded to 12 months, then it moved up to 18 months. What's interesting is if you talk to doctors who work on prison medicine and geriatrics, there's actually kind of a move away from this focus on prognosis because it's such an unspecific science. You can't really predict when someone is going to die, especially with certain diseases like cancer. So it's interesting that a lot of these statutes require this strict prognosis, this cutoff, when what you see in the records is it's very difficult to predict those kinds of things.
Well, Christy, you looked into over 5,000 applications for compassionate release at the federal level over a four-year period and found that in only 6% of cases, that seems like a low number from the outside, but what does that number say to you?
Well, to clarify, that 6% of cases is how many have been approved so far. So several hundred of those cases are still unresolved. They still haven't gotten a final answer. Several hundreds of those cases, the people died often before the case was even resolved. So the 6% doesn't mean that 94% were denied. But what it shows to me is that, you know, there's been years of pressure from advocacy groups, from Congress members in both parties, from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice, saying, you know, we should use this statute more liberally. There's maybe more cases that we should be looking at here. And what this data shows us is that even though there's also been a lot of changes in policy, expanding the criteria of who can apply, the numbers haven't changed all that much in terms of people that are actually getting out this way.
Is there countervailing pressure from Get Tough on Crime folks in politics who say, no, don't loosen up the criteria. These people should die in prison?
You know, the BOP wouldn't talk to us for this story. What we do know is from what the Department of Justice said in a sentencing commission hearing in 2016. And what they said is that they don't view this statute, they think the intent of it wasn't meant to allow for a broad reduction in the federal prison population, that this isn't the right way to try and get a lot of people out of federal custody. And also that they view it as part of their job to consider public safety, to consider whether someone's initial cry was too serious to let them out this way, or whether, you know, their disciplinary history in prison means that they shouldn't be let out.
Is there a financial case for compassionate release? If somebody's at the end of their life, their medical care can get very expensive very quickly. What if they stay in prison versus going to the outside for, say, the last 6 months of their life?
Well, that is one of the reasons why compassionate release is being talked about a lot more recently, is because the cost of healthcare in federal prisons has skyrocketed. It's grown by, I think, 30% in the last few years, according to Inspector General report. And so people are really looking for ways that they could drive down those costs. Another thing about the federal prison population is it's getting much older. The population is graying. The percent of inmates that are 55 and older has increased significantly. And we know that most of that spending on federal prison health care is for these inmates that have these terminal illnesses and inmates that are at the end of their life.
Now, Christy, you're focused here on the federal prison system, but that's a narrow slice of inmates across the country. Is there a lot of variation between states and how they handle compassionate release?
There is, and there actually isn't a bunch of good data that I've seen compiled so far in terms of how frequently it's used. Most states have some form of compassionate release. It's also called medical parole in some places, but it varies really widely as to how often it's used. And you see a lot of the same issues in terms of really high bar for getting release and long wait times and people dying before they can find out a final answer.
Christy Thompson with the Marshall Project. Christy, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick, and you're hearing sound there from 50 years ago this week, at the height of the civil rights era in America. Students at Howard University in Washington, D.C., as they took over the school's administration building.
We feel that the administration must give some public indication that they will move to establish democracy and a black-oriented curriculum before we can discontinue our protests. Our position is legitimate, and we must continue to push for all of our demands.
That's Adrian Mans Israel, one of the student protest leaders at Howard in 1968. The sit-in lasted several days. Martin Luther King would be assassinated less than 2 weeks after it ended. The sit-in was commemorated in an episode of the landmark documentary series Eyes on the Prize. Tony Gittins was a student leader on the Howard campus in 1968. 50 years ago this week, today he's director of the Washington, D.C. International Film Festival, and he looks back on those days of protest and talks about what he sees in student protesters of today.
It actually took years of working with students and trying to point out some of the problems, not only at the university, but in the United States at the time, to get to the point where the leaders of the sit-in were able to mobilize so many other students, some 1,200 students, to go into the administration building and sit there for 4 days. The university had tried to put several of us out of the university. As a matter of fact, they, the previous year, had expelled about 15 of us for essentially being protesters and disruptors of campus activities as they were going along, and we just had had enough. We were able to make that point to the other students that this was just unjust. And we started walking towards the administration building, and we thought that there would be usually about 50 of us who would be sitting there. And I remember turning around and seeing 100 or so students following us in there, which was quite amazing. Over maybe an hour, there were 1,200 students sitting in that building, refusing to get up until the university made some kind of reasonable response to our demands.
How did the imperatives of civil rights in those protests start to permeate Howard University? Because there were a lot of people sort of trying to keep the bubble inflated.
The Black Power movement was very strong in 68, 1967. Stokely Carmichael, the folks from SNCC and the other militants off of campus were demanding that the whole country turn around its racist attitudes towards African Americans then. Of course, we were part of that conversation, and I had spent some time with the SNCC folks down south. And we, of course, you know, wanted to be part of this historic movement to create environments in the United States where African Americans were treated properly.
There were a lot of different catalysts, as you said, Mr. Gittins, that led up to this moment on campus. One of them, a notable one, was a visit the year before by Muhammad Ali, the champ, who at the time was in the middle of one of the most famous Black Power and civil rights protests ever himself. Talk about that visit and what it meant.
Quite amazing. I was head of a committee, student committee called Project Awareness, and that committee brought speakers like Muhammad Ali to campus. And we just sort of knew that, heard that day that he was going to come, and the word went out on campus, and hundreds of students gathered in front of Douglas Hall where Muhammad Ali spoke. And people don't know how popular, internationally popular, this man was. He was a hero to all of us. He took a stand. And if someone like him can take a stand, I mean, it told us that we as students were privileged. I mean, you're a student in the United States at a campus like Howard University. You were privileged. If he could do it, we could do it. And we needed to do more than he was doing. So he was an inspiration to the kind of movement that led us into that building that day.
Mr. Gittins, one of your demands and the demands of other students in this movement was to identify Howard University as a Black university. Can you explain what that was about?
Students were treated as though we were children. There was compulsory ROTC. There were all kinds of demands on us to perform in a way that they felt were becoming to a Howard University student, which essentially were to be more white middle class kinds of people. And we didn't want that. We wanted a way to self-identify as African Americans and all that came with that, to feel comfortable in our own skin, so to speak. Internally, we wanted to have the curriculum geared towards the university as a service to the African-American community, that it should be a center of Black intelligentsia, Black research. The medical school should focus as much as it could on the needs of the Black community. On the outside, we felt that the university had created this bubble for itself, and we felt that the university should make greater efforts to relate to the community that was did have its needs. And the university, we felt, wasn't doing that.
And at the time, at your school, before the standoff and even during, there was pushback, of course, from administrators, but even from other African-American students, your colleagues, saying that Howard should just be a university that prepares Black students for what was called at the time by many of them mainstream American life, not a Black university per se.
Well, yes, that's true. But, you know, you find that kind of element and point of view on in all movements and all attempts to move the game forward. But I will say that in our case at Howard, that those folks came around and most of them found themselves sitting in that administration building right beside us.
Tony Gittins, you still live in Washington, D.C. today. Howard University is one of the preeminent African-American universities in America. What's the state of the school today in light of the sit-in that you engaged in 50 years ago?
Well, I would say that a lot of what we wanted then is being reflected in the university now. Many, many African-American studies programs, but there are also other facets of the university that would not exist without the sit-in and what some of us did that day. There is no more compulsory ROTC, and that wasn't by the insights of the leaders. It's because students prior to the sat in the president's office and insisted that go away.
When you survey the landscape of protest now, what do you see?
Well, I'm hoping that especially the students study the civil rights movement and learn from the history of the civil rights movement. And two things come to my mind. The first is that it's a long-term struggle. It's a long-term struggle. And I hope that the students at Stoneman Douglas and the parents of the folks at Sandy Hook, that it takes a long time. These people are not going to change their mind just like that. They are dug in. They the folks at the NRA are dug in. If one looks at the civil rights movement, you're talking about decades of hard work and struggle. And when the press goes away, you have to decide that you're just going to keep going. You're going to keep going until you get what you want. It will not happen overnight. What we found is that you got to cause the other side some kind of discomfort and pain. They are dug in, that they're not going to just all of a sudden decide sympathetically to take your side, and they have to feel some discomfort. It took years of us protesting and negotiating, and they spent a long time talking to these people over and over, and they'll sit on the other side of the table and listen to you and walk away and keep doing what they're doing. And that's how something like the sit-in at Howard occurred, that you get to the point that you say, enough, enough. I just don't trust you anymore. I got to do something to embarrass you. And that's what happens. And I just hope that the folks who are demonstrating and being activists now keep both of those in mind.
Tony Gittins was a student leader at the 1968 protests on Howard University's campus 50 years ago this week. Tony Gittins, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Todd.
Well, that's all for us today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.